Welcome to Power Play on the annual White Ribbon Day to remember the 14 female engineering students killed at L'École Polytechnique in Montreal 28 years ago today. While in China, the Prime Minister and his delegation honored the anniversary.
What happened in Montreal that day was a senseless act of violence that shocked the country and the world.
Yeah, the anniversary coincides with the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women. And this day was created as a direct response to the shooting. Well, coming up on today's show, Canada has rejected following President Donald Trump's lead in recognizing Jerusalem as the Israeli capital and to kickstart its embassy relocation from Tel Aviv. We will talk about what the U.S. move means with Palestine's representative to Canada and a former ambassador to Israel. Also, MPs are considering paternity benefits for the baby boom in the House of Commons, but should their benefits be higher than the average Canadian? We'll discuss that with the first MP couple to become parents while holding office. And the picture to my left is of our last second-hand military purchase. Those would be the oft dry dock subs we purchased from Britain in 1998. Today we learned used jets from Australia are headed for our Air Force. Our second-hand expert is standing by. But first, Canada flirted with the notion of a diplomatic shift to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel 27 years ago. It was quickly canceled as a bad idea. Today, the U.S. president decided to give it a try, and some believe it's still a very bad idea.
After more than two decades of waivers, we are no closer to a lasting peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. It would be folly to assume that repeating the exact same formula would now produce a different or better result. Therefore, I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
All right. Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland had a statement to say on this. She said Canada's longstanding position is that the status of Jerusalem can be resolved only as part of a general settlement of the Palestinian-Israeli dispute. We're strongly committed to the goal of a comprehensive, just and lasting peace in the Middle East, including the creation of a Palestinian state, living side by side in peace and security with Israel. Well, for more on the Arab world's reaction, let's bring in Nabil Maarouf. He's the chief representative of the Palestinian General Delegation to Canada. Welcome to the show, sir. I'm curious. Hamas said today that this opens the gates of hell with this move. Explain why it's so offensive to the Palestinians to see this move.
First of all, let me say that the new position of President Trump is not changing anything, because it's not changing the facts on the ground, because this decision is against the international law. It's against the international legitimacy. It's against the Security Council resolution and against especially the General Assembly resolution 181, which creates Israel. Mm-hmm. Because in this resolution, whole Jerusalem, West and East, is under international law. It's not part of Israel even.
He's still going to do it, though. It doesn't matter whether the
anyway,
UN
but
says.
It's not part of Israel even, mm-hmm. you know. So what's happening is not going to change anything, because the whole world is not in this position, because none of the whole countries all over the world establish or recognize this as a capital.
Okay, but why react against it so much? The Arab world's talking about days of rage against
it. For us, Jerusalem, first of all, it's our capital, occupied capital, occupied city since 1967 is Jerusalem. Second thing, it is the first holy places in all Muslim world, for all Muslims all over the world. It contains Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the Qibla, first Qibla of all Muslims. So none of the Muslims will accept to overcome, to take this city as a capital of Israel. It is a Palestinian territory, a Palestinian city.
What do you think of Canada's reaction? Should Canada have been more forceful in its reaction?
I think the position of which have been stated this morning, it's a reasonable position. It is because it is recognized the international law, and say that we cannot finalize this issue without a final status, final settlements for the conflict.
Do you believe this move makes peace closer or further away?
Further, because I'm telling you, this is, you know, all the events happened in the Middle East in the last decades. It is because there is no just solution to the Palestinian issue. Mm-hmm. Now, the United States, the broker, they are losing their credibility of being a broker in the Middle East. And this is means they are calling more violence or more reaction, more instability in the Middle East, and this is will enhance more, you see, terrorism in the area.
Really? I saw the Czech Republic recognize West Jerusalem as the capital. Is that start of a trend that worries you, or do you think that could be something you'd accept?
Let us be frank, mm-hmm. You know. Israel is already there, and even the resolution 181 didn't give the right to Israel to have Jerusalem as part of it. But recognizing the facts since between 48 till 67, the West Jerusalem was part of Israel. Now we are talking about the two-state solution depending on the 67 borders.
Right.
Some analysts were expecting President Trump to recognize West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Yeah. And this is means they leave the option of having East Jerusalem as the capital of the expected state. He didn't go that way. But, for instance, and this will be the final solution in all ways.
Right.
And Jerusalem is going to be two capitals for two states.
All right. Let's see what happens. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming on, sir.
Thank you.
All right. For another perspective, let's bring in a former chief of staff to Prime Minister Mulroney and a former Canadian ambassador to Israel. Norm Spector joins us from Victoria. Norm, this move make any sense to you?
Well, I don't think it's going to accomplish very much. Personally, I would have liked to see President Trump recognize West Jerusalem as the Israeli capital and leave open the possibility or commit the United States to recognizing East Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital when a peace agreement is achieved. Now, he did leave the door open, but I would have liked to see him go one step further and commit the United States to actually recognize East Jerusalem as the potential Palestinian capital.
All right. Do you think, in your view, we learned our lesson from the Joe Clark era, or should we even hint that we might follow suit? And does this put us off script with much U.S. foreign policy?
No, not really. I don't think we really have to do anything at this point other than to state our traditional position, even though, you know, what President Trump did, it's being condemned, of course. I mean, if President Trump were to present a resolution saying the earth is round, the majority of the United Nations would vote against it and say he was deranged. So anything that President Trump touches is going to turn to ash. But he does always seem to put his finger on the little absurdities and hypocrisies of foreign policy, including our own. You know, we'll meet with Israeli officials in West Jerusalem. We won't meet with Israeli officials in East Jerusalem. And when you ask the question of, I mean, what's really the difference between the two? West Jerusalem was occupied by Israel after the 1947-48 war, East Jerusalem after the 1967 war. So there are all these little hypocrisies and absurdities. And where Trump is right is that we've gotten really nowhere on the issue of peace in 60 years. So who knows? This might unblock the frozen process, but I don't think it accomplishes very much by itself.
Did you feel that Canada sufficiently walked the fence a bit to keep both sides happy with what it reacted to this like?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think the world or the Palestinians and Israelis are looking to Canada as the arbiter in this conflict. The other thing to point out is that though it went underreported largely in the Canadian media, Canada voted with Israel and four or five other countries, including the United States, last week on a UNESCO resolution. I think it was UNESCO. It was some UN body that essentially severed the link of Israel to all of Jerusalem, which is where a lot of the opposition to what Trump has done today is really coming from. I mean, you heard the Palestinian representative say that none of Jerusalem is really part of Israel, but some of it is kind of recognized as, inevitably. So, there's a lot of hypocrisy and there's a lot of things that aren't said in this conflict. And to the extent that Mr. Trump is polarizing the issue and getting to a few basic truths, such as the fact that West Jerusalem, part of Jerusalem, is going to be the capital of Israel. I mean, if there's a peace agreement, I would argue that so will part of Jerusalem be part of the Palestinian capital. But he's at least saying a truth that governments that have preceded him, including the government of Canada, have not been willing to say.
Interesting. What do you think is going to be the impact? Is going to be a lot of violence reacting to this, Norm, or do you think they might shrug it off eventually?
Well, there will be some street protests, but, for Hamas to be saying that this opens the gates of hell, I mean, let's be honest about this. Hamas believes and says that the mere existence of Israel is a sacrilege. So let's not get, so yes, there will be protests, but I don't think that will get out of hand for one principal reason, that the real conflict in the Middle East now is not over Israel and Palestine. It never really has been. It's been the rhetoric, but it hasn't been. The real conflict now is between Iran, representing Shia Muslims, and Saudi Arabia, Sunni Muslims. And the Saudis and the Egyptians are not going to let this get out of hand. I think King Hussein of King Abdullah of Jordan is going to have a bit of an issue controlling his population, which is largely Palestinian. But I don't think this will get out of hand.
All right. That's another topic altogether, Norm. But hard to keep track of all our conflicts over there. But always appreciate your views on this. You know what you're talking about. Thanks again. All right. You'd like to hear your views on this subject or any other topic on the show, please reach out through social media on Facebook and Twitter or Instagram, or contact us via email. Our address is powerplay@ctvnews.ca. Meanwhile, Justin Trudeau's trip through China neared its conclusion today without a formal launch to free trade talks so far. CTV's Glenn McGregor is covering the tour. Glenn, bring us up to speed on what happened today.
Don, the Prime Minister returns to Canada tomorrow, and unless there's a sudden breakthrough in talks with the Chinese in the coming hours, he'll be heading home without a framework in place to hold future free trade talks. The Trade Minister, François-Philippe Champagne, is still in Beijing trying to hammer something out, but staff in the Prime Minister's office don't sound particularly confident. Tonight, they were downplaying the significance of getting that framework in place before Trudeau leaves. And they were noting that he's committed to annual meetings with the Chinese leadership, so they don't really see any hard deadline here. Now, in Guangzhou, Trudeau gave the keynote address to leaders of some of the world's biggest multinational corporations at a conference sponsored by Fortune magazine. The speech was really mostly a sales pitch to CEOs to do more business in Canada, and it hit on his usual themes about progressive trade and inclusive growth.
The opportunities that can be found in Canada are tremendous. We've got great people, and we've got a phenomenal business environment. What's more, we understand the importance of working with our international partners. In this new era where change is constant, countries will only succeed if they work together.
Afterwards, Trudeau met briefly with one of those CEOs, Apple's Tim Cook, and they apparently talked about investment opportunities in Canada. Also at the same conference, the U.S. ambassador to China, and he let slip a little bit of news. He said that Trudeau will be meeting on December 19th with U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson about the security situation involving North Korea. That seemed to catch the PMO a little bit off guard because they haven't announced that meeting publicly. And tonight, they are refusing to confirm the date or even say where it will occur, either in Washington or somewhere in Canada. But it does suggest that there could be a role for Canada here as an intermediary. It's worth noting that Trudeau talked about the North Korea situation last night with a big player in all of this, Chinese President Xi Jinping. Don.
All right, thanks, Glenn. We always learn about what's going on in Trudeau's dealings with America from the White House. Strange. Anyway, coming up, shipbuilding turbulence and secondhand planes interrupt Canada's military spending spree. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, it's the 20th anniversary of Canada's purchase of four submarines from Britain for $750 million. Those hapless, off-broken-down fleet is now 2 years into a seven-year repair budget worth $2.6 billion. Those condemned to forget their history are doomed to repeat it, and sources are telling the Canadian press that the purchase of new jet fighters will be delayed until 2026, and used fighters from Australia will fill what the Air Force calls a capability gap. To discuss the military maneuvers that are in the air and on the water, let's bring in procurement expert David Perry of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. I don't understand why they can't buy equipment. We had helicopters that we had still flying Sea Kings that were supposed to be replaced back in Gretchen's era. Why can't we just order some jet fighters?
I think we could. Why it would take 8 years, as the Canadian press is suggesting, to actually see the first one delivered, that's beyond my comprehension.
And the first one delivered doesn't mean a fleet of jet fighters. It means the first one.
Absolutely. So you'd have your first aircraft delivered, and then you'd have to learn how to operate it, develop the doctrine, get all the training cadres, all that kind of thing. So it would be longer than that until we could actually retire our existing 30-plus-year-old fleet of CF-18s.
So our solution to not having enough planes to meet our Air Force commitments is to buy these used ones from Australia, because we had this little fit of pique over the Boeing interfering in our Bombardier procurement. Does that make any sense to you? Are these jets we're buying any different than the ones we're having trouble keeping in the air now?
So they're similar. I don't think it would make a sense as simply in a reasonable time frame just buying a new fleet. But if we can't do that in anything less than 8 years, then the logic of going to Australia and getting more jets, which are about the same age, same vintage, pretty comparable to the ones we have now, buying a bunch of them to try and bolster the numbers of jets that we have right now that could at any given day be operationally ready would help address the problem the government's identified.
All right, so I'm assuming we get these jets from Australia, and much like the British subs, they're going to need to be retrofitted or whatever. How big a project is that going to be?
So it depends on how many we get and exactly how much we want to modify them. I think the good news and the thing that makes this different than the submarine purchase is that Canada is unfortunately quite good at operating 30-plus-year-old CF-18s. So to purchase some from Australia, we've done the modifications before. Our industry knows how to do that. We know how to fly and operate them. So it'll be hopefully be much, much different than the sub purchase.
I don't want you to get into political interpretation, but I'll throw a theory out at you. The Liberals know they're going to have to break the promise not to buy the F-35s eventually. They're just trying to kick this can past the next election so that they don't look like they break it in this mandate. Does that sound right to you?
Well, it certainly looks like the can's being kicked down the road. I mean, why that is, again, it's just beyond me why it would take 8 years. But that would certainly move this out beyond the next election. And on this timeline, the one after that.
And you still believe it's inevitable that we'll be doing the F-35s?
It depends on how they structure the competition, what they ask for, how they set the price points, what they ask for in terms of industrial offsets, and how much value they give to the work the Canadian companies have already won under the Joint Strike Fighter project. So I don't think it's a done deal.
All right. I got to ask you about ships now, if I may. There's another report out there that we've rejected a joint proposal from Paris shipholders to build warships in France. And it looks like we'd save about, I don't know, half the $60 billion estimate for our warships that would be built here in Canada. What do you make of that? Was that a realistic bid that France was putting in Or was the government right to reject it because it didn't play by the procurement rules?
I think the government was right to say that they're not going to evaluate it. I mean, they've launched a process, they've extended it, they've modified it a number of times, even after launching it, to really try and maximize the chances that any company that was interested in bidding could bid and then have a chance of being successful. So the fact that they're rejecting a proposal that's come in outside of that competitive process is no surprise, and I think it's the right thing to do.
All right, David, you make sense out of nonsense in my view, but thank you for coming on. Appreciate it anyway.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Coming up, the MPs discuss the latest demands from the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women Inquiry. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Our midweek wonders of political posturing are here to discuss today's percolating issues. Candace Bergen is the official opposition House leader, Peter Julian, the NDP House leader, and drumroll please, Marco Mendicino is the Liberal Parliamentary Secretary of Justice.
Correct.
Welcome to the show again. Nice to have you all with us. I want to talk about these planes, I guess, a little bit, because used military equipment doesn't have a great track record with Canada, those submarines, as I was referring to. I mean, Candace, I guess I sound a little frustrated when David came out. I said, why can't we make a decision? What do you think's going on here?
From the onset, the Liberals' decisions around this were political. They made the announcement right off the hop that they were going to be buying the Super Hornets from Boeing. Now they've reversed this decision because of a trade war. And now, like, what did they do? Go on Kijiji.com or something and, like, let's find gently used airplanes,
you know,
only driven to church and back, you know, not like, seriously. And we're going back to the decade of darkness when we have to be purchasing used fighter jets that Australia doesn't want anymore because the Liberals have botched this up so badly. They could have continued with the open competition and we could be well on our way to seeing our men and women in uniform have the proper equipment, but the Liberals have botched it yet again.
Peter?
We've had a few decades of darkness around military procurement, and we saw with the F-35s what a botched job the former Conservative government did, and now the Liberals are going down the same road, and what we need is an open competition that is free from interference. And this is something that Liberals and Conservatives don't seem to understand, that's the only way, the proper way, to equip our military is to have that open competition, to free it up from political interference. That's certainly what happened with the shipbuilding strategy. We should learn from that, and we need to make sure that that equipment is in place in the time that is required.
I'm sure we've had open competitions. I've seen ad blitzes and lobbying going like crazy, and yet we seem to get to a point where we make a decision and then there's an election and everything gets upturned.
A little rich coming from the Conservatives. I mean, they talk about a decade of darkness. They were conducting procurement in the medieval times. This capability gap grew under their tenure. We're trying to close it. Minister Sajjan has put out the RFP. An appropriate announcement will be made at the right time. There are a lot of factors that go into this decision, Don. We're talking about an important part of our Canadian forces. You've got to look at range, maneuverability, payload. And we've got to make sure that we get the right fighter jet, which we'll do.
I'm just curious, do you think the government made the right move, Candace, in canceling the Super Hornets with a Boeing because they played funny business with our Bombardier contract?
Boeing, there are a lot of jobs in Manitoba and Winnipeg for Boeing. So you can't, like, fix a wrong decision with another wrong decision. The way that they went about announcing this was wrong. To go cancel it now because of a trade war just again shows the mismanagement of the file, the mismanagement of the whole issue. And to Marco's point, you know, the Minister of Defense said that they would not be purchasing used fighter jets. He made that commitment. And now this is the first thing that they're having to do to get themselves out of the mess
Maybe
that they created.
Maybe they're gently used.
Well, that's what I said, only driven to church and back or something like that.
Peter, should they cancel that? You know, should they be giving Boeing the business, or are they making the right move because they got a point of principle
here? They should not be interfering, and this is what we've seen under both governments, both Conservatives and Liberals. They need to have an open competition that allows for us to actually meet those capabilities, and we're not seeing it. That's what's unfortunate about all this, Don. And we had the shipbuilding strategy. It's being underfunded now and slowing down, and that's leading to more job losses, as you know, mm-hmm. in shipyards across the country. We have to take some pride in our abilities, but make sure that those competitions are open and free from the kind of political interference that we've seen over the last few decades.
And they will remain open, and options are going to remain open. Minister Sejan has said that, and we're going to reject the jet lag logic that we hear from the Conservatives and continue on with the process that matters, like both that, for the interim need as well as the long-term lead. We want to get 88 fighter jets eventually. That's something that you can't do overnight. It's going to take a number of years to procure, but we've got the right process in place, and we'll stick to it.
So before I'm 6 feet under, you're going to have jet fighters here in Canada? Like, you get new ones, right?
I don't know how you at least, you can't say that you've got the right process in place when you have fumbled it so badly, and you're at the point you're at right now.
I mean, I press you on the CP story, saying, you know, the first one's still going to be 2026, but, you know, you're not the Defense Parliamentary Secretary, so I think I'll let you say, stay tuned, right? That's what you're going to say?
Well, exactly, and this has got to be taken care of. This is a decision that's going to be taken carefully and at the right time.
I think we all think the murdered and missing Indigenous women inquiry's well-intentioned. It's trying to do something right. But my goodness, today Michelle Audette, one of the four commissioners that's left, says she's furious at her own inquiry and says it's got to reopen all the cases into murdered and missing Indigenous women. And there might be some question whether the commissioners stick around if they don't get an extension beyond a year from now. Peter, what do you make of that? I mean, you're from BC. A lot of these murdered and missing women were from BC. Have we given them a sufficient mandate, or do you think that this inquiry is going to be incomplete if we don't expand it?
It's very clear when you talk to the victims' families, that is what they want to see, an expanded inquiry. It's very clear as well that there hasn't been the resources put into the inquiry for it to do the appropriate justice to all of those victims. And I think it's sad, Dawn, where today on December 6th across Canada, we're commemorating the massacre of those 14 women at the Polytechnical School in Montreal. We need to have government actually weigh in and ensure the resources are there so that this inquiry can succeed. And I am very saddened by the fact that the resources haven't been there and that the commissioners see that the inquiry is not getting the support that it so richly deserves.
But, Kat, is this spilling outside its mandate into some giant thing that's trying to solve every case or reopen every case? I mean, would you ever... This thing could be without end.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know if that's the right way to characterize it. You will know, and Markle will remind you, that we as Conservatives didn't initially want this inquiry because we wanted something that would result in two main things. First of all, these horrible acts of violence against Indigenous women stopped. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the everyday lives of Indigenous women and girls made better and safer. When the Liberals won government, it was clear that the Canadian people wanted to see this inquiry. We wanted to get 100% behind it, which is what we did. What we're seeing now, though, is very heartbreaking. It's very sad to see. I mean, we've had 20 people either fired or quit who are part of the inquiry. We have seen families who have not been engaged in the process. Mm-hmm. And what we haven't seen is the Liberals say, okay, hang on, this isn't working. We have to press the reset button, and we recognize it. Instead of the Liberals continuing to defend it or the minister defend it, they have to press reset so that ultimately those two goals are achieved. We find out what's happened so it can stop, and we help women and girls whose lives are not safe and they need their lives to be improved.
Margot, I'm curious, though. I mean, this inquiry seems to be looking back a lot when it's supposed to be looking for ways to reconcile and heal, yet it wants to go back and reopen all the wounds again. Is that a misguided approach?
No, I don't think so. I think you have to do both. And I want to attribute myself to Peter's statements, obviously to Minister Monsef, who made a statement in the House today. And today of all days, I think we should be joined at the hip on making a statement against violence against women and girls.
That's been done.
Inquiry is obviously a real focal point for the Indigenous community. Mm-hmm. Their voices need to be heard. And you can't just forget about the past. And you need to have a process in place, a forum where they can express themselves in a way that is consistent with their traditions, where those voices are respected. It's obviously very difficult. The work of the inquiry is independent from the government. They've been given the mandate, and we will support them as best as we can. I would also note that, you know, there have been resources which have been put forward to try and make a difference tangibly in the lives of people who live in Indigenous communities, and particularly focusing on women's shelters and girls and children and so on and so forth. These are important things which I hope all parties will be united in supporting.
very quickly.
I also would say, sorry, I know that originally the Conservatives said they didn't support the inquiry, but I'm glad that Rona Ambrose, the former leader of the opposition, did do a turnabout on that, and she did support the creation of the inquiry. I think that was an important moment.
She did.
Well, don't forget, we are the party that gave women unreserved property rights, matrimonial property rights, which was opposed by both parties, which, you know, I think if you want to help women who are in a potentially violent situation, you say to them, when you leave your violent spouse, you're going to have your property rights. I think that's one of the key things we can do to help women.
Okay.
And we did that.
Enough said. Thank you all. I'm not here next week, so have a happy holiday.
Happy holidays.
See you on 2018.
Are they going to prorogue in January? What's your bet?
You know what? Truthfully, I think that they need to have another speech from the throne. So I would expect that they would probe maybe just for a short time.
I'm not even going to ask you guys. All right. Thank you both. See you in 2018.
Thanks.
In other news, Fisheries and Oceans Minister Dominic LeBlanc has revealed he's fighting chronic lymphocytic, I think that's how you pronounce it, leukemia, which is very treatable. Here's what he told reporters earlier today.
I lived for many, many, many years with it, decades. I read that Paul Henderson gave an interview some years ago talking about his circumstance. So this has reminded me of a lot of people who live with a lot worse conditions. I decided to start the treatments now as a way to take advantage of a bit of a lull in the parliamentary schedule. And the doctors are confident, and that was my discussion with the Prime Minister last week, that I'll be able to maintain a normal work and personal routine. I'm hoping for a lot of snow in New Brunswick. I bought a snowmobile last year. I've got a big skidoo, so if we get a lot of snow, I'll be able to spend more time in January on the trails than I would otherwise.
Oh, he'll beat it. All right, coming up, two MPs, one newborn baby, and the struggle to balance parliamentary duties with diaper changes. Please stay with us. Welcome back. A report into life for young parents in the House of Commons recommends changes to parental leave, allowing infants to be on the floor, and improved child care facilities. To discuss life on the Hill as a parent with a young child, we're joined by two Bloc Quebecois MPs who had a baby son together. That's little Ulysses, born on September 7th. Marilyn Gill and Xavier Barraslou Duval join me in the studio. Ulysses kicked up quite a fuss today in the House.
You know,
he heard Elizabeth May talking and he started crying out.
That's why he's sleeping right now.
That was kind of funny. Well, tell us how is Ulysses and how are you handling having a baby and continuing your parliamentary duties? How difficult is it?
Yeah, we have to do three or four things at the time, like I believe every parent have to do. Well, we have to cope with what it is to have an infant, a young kid. And I believe we shouldn't ask ourselves questions before thinking of having one. We just cope with it every day and we're kind of inventing what it is to be two parents in Parliament, having a baby.
Do they have the facilities to handle this? I mean, you're in the Commons. Mm-hmm. What happens when Ulysses says, I need a diaper change right now. What happens?
Well, there are facilities, but we didn't know that there were at first. There were at the sixth floor. There's a small piece where we can go. It's for all MPs. So any MPs who has a baby can go there. For now, it's still okay because they're not too much baby. But I don't know in a couple of years, it's because the MPs are younger and younger by the time, and there's more women too. So maybe it will need to get an expansion because the room will be too small, I think, in a couple of years. For now, it's doing the job, but there could be more facilities, sure.
Like Carina Gould's pregnant, mm-hmm. Nikki Ashton just had twins. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I think it's a baby boom underway.
Yes.
I do want to talk about this report because it raises an interesting question, problem I didn't know existed. MPs don't pay into employment insurance, and they can't claim employment insurance, so they don't get paid maternity leave. What's that like for you? Does that force you back to work?
Well, in Quebec, it's different because we pay employment insurance separately from there's a regime which is called the Régime Québécois d'assurance parentale. Mm-hmm. But as an MP, we don't pay it anyway. Uh-huh. But it's important to know because we don't. Take employment insurance when the parents go to leave for maternity or paternity in Quebec.
So what are you supposed to do? I mean, in your case, are you supposed to go without being paid anything? Because you get docked pay if you're not in the House of Commons.
Like the report said, they allow people when they're not in the House, they don't cut off.
$120 a day.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Something, right?
But I can only speak for myself. That's not in the report. But I did not want to take a leave because, like I said, I'm not sick. I was okay. Of course, I was lucky. I gave birth on the 7th of September, not on the 25th, or when we were back to the house. So
right.
I was lucky. But maybe for some would be good to have a leave. For example, when we gave birth, sometimes it takes more than a week or two before we can go back to normal activities.
I guess the concern was raised by the conservatives that if they go ahead with the plan as presented, that you wouldn't be docked pay for being on parental leave, that you would get full pay while you're away. And that's actually better than most Canadians would get unless they get topped up by their company. Is that fair?
Well, the MPs are paid for a mandate. They're not paid for the hour they work. Some MPs work a lot, others work less. In the opposition, we work a lot. MPs in government doesn't all work a lot. But I know it's my small partisan sentence, I think that's a good thing that there's a stability in the way MPs are paid. But Marilyn skipped 2 weeks, so it's not that much. You skipped 1 week, yeah, because she stopped 2 weeks, but 1 week at the parliament, and me,
ready.
I didn't stop at all. So in our case, it would be hard to say, well, they should be paid less because we are doing the job and with the baby and we like this, but it's a challenge.
Yeah, I could imagine. Marilyn, what would be on your wish list for 2018 to help make parents make it easier to be a parent of a baby and an MP at the same time? What needs to be done?
For my example, I come from a riding which is something like 900 kilometers away from Ottawa, so I have to travel. Of course, this is okay, but it's difficult to have family, for example, or to have people to take care of the kids. And I would like to have a daycare, for example, at 6 months of age, not right now.
It's 18 months now.
Yeah, it's 2 years old, yeah. So it's going to be in the next mandate. It would be easier. So if we have a daycare on the hill, that would be something great. A space also, because like you mentioned, there are a lot of MPs, Ms. Ashton, Ms. Gould will have it. I said MPs, but of course there could be men also. I know some colleagues from the NPD, which are not too far from where I'm seated, have had babies too. So there should be room also, and maybe just near the house as well, because of course changing the diapers, we don't have to go that far. Or we have to breastfeed sometimes, or there's just a little noise. So maybe space, a daycare, and maybe remote votes. That's something that I would like, because not for a year, but for a couple of weeks, maybe.
An example, it happened today. At the end of the question period, the baby was crying loud.
Yeah.
So Marilyn got out of the chamber, but a vote started at the same time, so she missed the vote.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay. I think he was just voting in opposition or whatever.
Well, usually we try to vote with the baby.
Cute baby. He's giving me the stare, so I think he wants to be fed, so I'll let you both go. But thank you both for coming in. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
The Chinese media go on the attack against the Canadian media tracking Trudeau. We'll talk about that right after these messages. Please stay with us. All right, it's Wonderful Wednesday, and that means the most fun-loving duo in the National Press Gallery here to try and keep from losing it. That's not a battle with you two. Susan Delacour writes for iPolitics on the Toronto Star. Jolteni Bellavance, bureau chief for La Presse. Welcome to the show.
Good to see you, Don.
A weirdest thing, I've never seen this before. The Chinese media on Justin Trudeau's tour are piling on our poor, humble reporters that are out there, including our very own CTV, Glenn McGregor. I'll just give you a sample here of what's being written and put on video. The superiority and narcissism of the Canadian media is beyond words, said one. China is not in a rush to develop its relations with Canada. Let it be. This is the most genuine attitude of Chinese society. And this says, Canadian media should understand how little influence their country has in China. If you continue to trade with China and benefit from it, you shouldn't let your foul-mouthed media continue their deeds. Well, fighting words. What do you make of this, JD?
Wondering what they would have said if I had gone to China.
Well, they would have been all over. Well, you write in French. They might not have figured
that's
it
right.
out.
Would have needed a translation. It's a change of tone on the part of China.
Oh,
like a couple of, last year when the Prime Minister of China came here, he was pushing for a free trade agreement. Now it's the total opposite view. And it's sad for the Prime Minister who was there to try to seal the deal. He's not getting much out of this visit that we expected that he would get. Business people thought this was going to be the goal for the free trade negotiation. It's not. Bombardier thought that the Prime Minister would announce also, confirm the sale of some planes to Chinese companies over there. It didn't happen. So a lot of the stuff that we're trying to get together before the visit just fell through. And now with this kind of comments from the Chinese media is like, I mean, it's the official statement of the Communist Party.
Right.
You know,
this isn't like us saying it. It's like the government saying, you say this to those wretched reporters.
The Chinese president almost pushed a sad button on this one. So, it's not very good for the Prime Minister, I would say, in Canada.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hadn't seen the government hate we Canadian reporters since Harper was in power.
Maybe he's over there consulting.
but the more serious thing, I actually think it's interesting.